From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 4 months after hurricanes slammed Puerto Rico, a plea: don't forget those who are suffering.
They're people, and they do need help.
Plus, should psychiatrists air concerns about President Trump's mental fitness?
Those on your side will cheer for you, and the other side will put you in the box of the bad, which may hurt our field, and that's where I am concerned.
A new film explores being the other.
The secret to unity is really, really simple. It's just learning about one another and telling stories and realizing how similar we are.
The anniversary of the Surgeon General's report on smoking.
They found all that these studies said quite clearly what was later put on the cigarette package, warning these cigarettes may be hazardous to your health.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been 4 months since hurricanes Irma and then Maria slammed into Puerto Rico. The death toll, the damage to the island, unprecedented. The power grid and water infrastructure were torn apart, triggering a health crisis. And all this time later, many people in the American territory are in limbo. Best estimates put around half the nation without power. And some experts say people in Puerto Rico might not get power back in some parts of the territory until the spring. Marta Smith Cruz of Livonia has been leading a relief effort for Puerto Rico since September. She is focusing on her hometown of Ceiba, and she's with us now to bring us up to date. How did Hurricane Maria affect Ceiba? Give us a sense of the before and the after.
Before and after, well, before everything was fine. Everybody could go to work. Everybody had their cars. Everybody was able to get to the grocery store. There were supplies. Today, there are people in areas of Ceiba that have no power yet. The water is intermittent. The water is not potable, so they're on a boil water advisory. There are a lot of people that still think that even though it's a boil water advisory, it's okay to drink it. So you're seeing a lot of health issues. There are people that have been sick. They don't have the ability to wash their hair with clean water, for example. So they're getting sores on their head because they're using, you know, dirty water or water that shouldn't be used. It's very, not even old school, but just primitive.
Very, very. Primitive. We're seeing reports, Marta, of a sharp spike in suicides in Puerto Rico in the aftermath of the hurricanes, including among young people. Are you seeing that kind of toll in Ceiba?
I haven't had any reports of that. However, we have heard of people within the community that have had family members that have been affected by suicide in the immediate area. So maybe not in our hometown, but maybe in neighboring cities. That's certainly true.
I can only imagine, and I challenge everybody listening. We all think about how annoyed we are when we lose power for an afternoon. And then it comes back on and you can put the lights on and live your life. And when you think that here it is, 4 months later with no end in sight, what do you see people doing to get through? What kind of internal fortitude are they mustering to just get through this?
Losing power and losing electricity is not uncommon on the island. There are times where you lose power for some unknown reason and then it comes back, or the water goes because they're doing some work. So it's not something that is uncommon. But having no power and no water and no communication on top of that, I think all of those combined is really what makes it more difficult. Not having electricity, okay, fine, you know, it gets dark around 7 or 8 o'clock and you use candles and lanterns and things like that, but it's getting tiring and you can't even imagine the expense of people that have generators that have to spend $40 to $60 per day sometimes just to keep the generators running.
Now, you've made several trips down. What kinds of things are you bringing when you go back to Ceiba?
On my very first trip, I was very lucky. I was able to get a flight on Delta, and they allowed me to take 10 boxes and bags up to 100 pounds each, and that's because I booked my flight before they put an embargo on. As soon as they saw that people were doing the same thing, they put an embargo on it because the weight limits were just astronomical. So the things that we were taking were, I shipped generators. Those had to go through cargo because those are not allowed as passenger cargo. But we took food, we took water, we took things like water filtration systems, like individual water bottle sized ones. We took some that would do 5 to 10 gallons at a time. We took solar chargers that could charge cell phones, that could charge fans, batteries, things like that. And things like that are still needed.
How can concerned people, hearing you describe the desperate conditions in Ceiba, how can concerned people here in Michigan best help people in Puerto Rico?
I'll give you a perfect example. We have 18 pallets of water sitting in a warehouse that we need to ship, and we need to raise funds for that. Or we need an organization to step forward and say, hey, we'll donate a flight for you in order to get all of this stuff down there. But it's really difficult being a small organization with people from the area working together to raise those kinds of funds. And because we're not a known shipper, with all of the limitations that there are on shipping cargo, because we're not a known shipper, we can't even go to FedEx and say, we have a cargo shipment that's this many tons and send it down there. You know, we need monetary contributions, but we also need things like generators or gas cards and gift cards for people to be able to purchase items that are now available on the island.
So, Marta, I understand the many groups that have been trying to provide relief to people in Puerto Rico have kind of united here in Southeast Michigan. So how can people who want to help tap into that?
So we actually came together to form a group called Comité Cultural Boricua de Detroit. And what we've been doing is we've been maximizing all of our efforts in order to bring resources together, including monetary donations. And we're all working together through a group called Grace in Action, which is located in Detroit. And we actually have an event tonight, which is going to be a fundraiser. We're hoping to raise $1,500 in order to get a water filtration system sent to the island.
What do you want people to know about the people of Puerto Rico and how they've coped with this?
I want people to understand that we are their fellow citizens. I want people to know that the people of Puerto Rico are super resilient. They've overcome many obstacles. They've gone through a lot of hardship just based on the economic status of the island over the past several years. And I want people to know that they do need help because they are just like you and I, they're people, and they do need help.
Marta Smith Cruz, thank you so much for sharing your relief efforts for your hometown of Ceiba in Puerto Rico. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
For most of us, working in sub-zero temperatures does not sound like the dream job. But for world championship ice carver Tajana Rauker, the cold doesn't bother her anyway. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia caught up with Rauker at her Ice Dream studio in Plymouth. That's where she's preparing to showcase her ice sculptures at this weekend's Plymouth Ice Festival.
It's just as cold inside the warehouse as it is outside. And Rauker is already at work with her yellow chainsaw in hand and wearing full-on winter gear.
There is lots of layers. It's very cold, so you definitely have to have your snowsuit on and your turtleneck, of course, and heavy boots, gloves, and ear protection because I'm working with the chainsaw and die grinders and heavy tools, which are noisy.
All around, there are big, clear blocks of ice. Each are roughly 3 feet high by 2 feet wide. Two rows of giant ice makers and two large freezers fill the warehouse.
Where I have, I carve, this is inside of the freezer. I store my blocks of ice inside. I can carve, I have my tools in here. Usually I carve on the 9 degrees.
9 degrees?
Yes. So this last week it was warmer in my freezer than outdoors.
Rauker says she left her home country of Croatia to find a better life in Michigan. But ice carving wasn't always her first dream. She says she studied to be a chef, and that's where she discovered carving. Small pieces of fruits and vegetables.
Many times you don't think that you can make a little basket from lemons. You don't think you can make flowers from tomatoes and watermelons and all these, they can be part of art. And then I saw these big blocks of ice and I'm like, whoa, I got to carve these. And so this is going to be the carving for the Westbourne Market. Then I have here the one for the Miller Lite in color. See?
Oh, wow. And I see here some swans, a Buddha.
This is for one of the yoga room we're doing every year. Yep.
There's a seahorse and a horse and all kinds, a dollar sign.
Yeah. I'm carving with the chisel this front part of the ice carving where the flower is going to be. I'm removing the top surface of the ice. And then there are, inside there are carved radishes. And then we can take a torch and we can clean the, you know, the whole ice carving. And it gets clear and then you can see what is inside. You can see through the ice carving.
Usually Rauker starts with a sketch and then transfers the drawing to the ice block. But her preferred method is just taking her chainsaw and using her imagination. She says if you can imagine it, she can carve it.
We majority do the ice carvings for the corporate and for birthdays, for bar mitzvahs, for weddings, which are very popular. Any kind of parties, you know, wherever there is some kind of commotion going on, there can be an ice carving. And they can even be the small ice cubes, you know, in your glass or shot glasses from ice. Or the big ice bars and, you know, larger creations like 13-foot Eiffel Tower or right in the middle of your dance floor.
Rauker has won a ton of awards, some in Michigan, Ohio, and nearby states. She's won 7 championships in Alaska, one for her 25-foot frozen giraffe. She also competes internationally. And Rauker is one of the very few women carving ice professionally.
No, not many women carvings, unfortunately. It's fun, though. I don't know why. A little harder, but it's fun. So I try to, you know, do the best I can, no matter what you are.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You may recall the TV series Mad Men was set in the 60s. The creators went to great pains to make it look as authentic as possible, and that meant just about every character smoked, everywhere, all the time. It's a good reminder of just how much attitudes have changed towards cigarettes and smoking. And that's largely due to something that happened on this day in 1964. It's the day when the U.S. Surgeon General took on the big tobacco lobby and issued his famous report on smoking. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is back with us. And Howard, we're talking about Surgeon General Luther Terry. What did Dr. Terry say in his report that was so groundbreaking?
Well, Dr. Terry was appointed by John F. Kennedy in 1961. He was a cardiologist and very interested in the effects of smoking on the cardiovascular system, but also on the lungs, obviously. And he gathered together over a 14-15-month period more than 7,000 studies on the effects of smoking on the body. Now, you know, it's tough to do a study on smoking on a human being because you can't really do a controlled experiment. You have to do what's called an association study, which was a new concept in epidemiology.
And what does that mean?
So that means you, after the fact, you don't give one group of people cigarettes and another, a blind group or a control group, not cigarettes.
The way we do, the way we see in pharmaceutical studies.
Yeah, with rats.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, for some reason, that's not acceptable in humans. I'm being facetious. Yes. It's not acceptable. And so you have to do an epidemiological study, a mathematical study, looking post facto at the number of people who smoked and the diseases they developed. And he found, they found this 10-person committee, five were smokers, five were not. They found that, of course, it caused a great deal of lung cancer, emphysema, bladder cancer, peptic ulcer disease. They had a 70% greater risk of heart attacks, and on and on and on. They found all that these studies said quite clearly what was later put on the cigarette package, warning these cigarettes may be hazardous to your health.
But that took a while. So this report comes out. What kind of pushback happened from the tobacco industry?
Well, the tobacco industry then and now has a long history of pushing back.
Watch The Insider.
Yes.
Movie The Insider, for
that's
example.
That's a wonderful
of that.
Example
yeah.
of that. And it can get quite scary. You know, tobacco has been part of the American economy since colonial days. And so if you go to the United States Capitol, you'll see tobacco leaves inscribed or chiseled out in bas relief in the facade. And the tobacco companies pushed back by discrediting the study, by marketing to groups who had not previously been big smokers, like women, you've come a long way, baby.
Virginia Slims.
Right.
Yeah.
As well as minority groups with big billboards in their neighborhoods. They gave out free cigarettes. They had their own research that was done. They battled it to a fairly well. And it wasn't really until the 80s, the 1980s, when another famous Surgeon General, C. Everett Koop, worked very hard with the medical profession and the healthcare professions to ban cigarettes from, say, a hospital.
To think that there used to be
yeah,
people smoking everywhere.
Exactly. Or an airplane. You know, remember the back
yes.
of the airplane you could smoke? Well, you know, that air is recirculating. It's
absolutely.
Silly. And restaurants, bars, mm-hmm. et cetera. And so now we're used to that, but it was a big deal.
I have to wonder that famous warning that popped up on the cigarette packs as a result, and it took a few years for that to
yes.
happen as a result of this study. You know, you look at that warning through 2018 eyes, and it's tempting to go, well, no kidding, it's hazardous for your health. We get that. What
right.
else is new? Really, though, how significant was this warning, and did it really keep smokers from buying those packs of cigarettes? Did it help cut into usage?
I think it did. You have to remember that before 1964, more than 50% of all American adults smoked.
That citing Mad Men was that jumped
yeah.
out at me. Was every she's pregnant and she's smoking and they're smoking
right.
and the everybody was lighting up. Yeah.
Right, and watch movies, watch
yes.
old movies that were made in 1960 mm-hmm. or 1950 or what have you, and smoking was considered almost romantic and glamorous. It was not really considered a health hazard. Frequently, doctors were enlisted in the sales of cigarettes. Remember, 4 out of 5 doctors prefer Camels. Now, that was actually a sham. It was
yeah.
based on doctors leaving a medical meeting, and members of the Philip Morris sales team were handing out free samples of Camel cigarettes.
This was in the 1950s.
And
yeah.
4 out of 5 doctors took them, hence they preferred them. There were also, scientists involved who would discredit these studies, particularly the Association Epidemiological Studies, which were new and really constitute a new way of knowing that we think about all the time today. But you're right. Today it's like, duh, mm-hmm. cigarettes are dangerous. It was not really well appreciated. Now, I do think the Terry Report had a great effect on the diminution, the decline of people smoking cigarettes in America.
Over the course of time.
Yeah, it's about 15.1% today. It was about 20% only a few years ago. It's not only the Dr. Terry Report. It's all the things that have happened, a great deal of activism that has resulted.
So he kind of uncorked the bottle, so to speak.
And yeah, he let the genie out of the bottle.
Let the genie out of the bottle. So if you were making a list of U.S. Surgeons General who really made a true measurable difference in public health, an activist Surgeon General, where would Dr. Luther Terry be in your view?
Well, he would be number 1 through 5. He was incredibly influential. We don't really remember his name. In fact, we don't remember the names of many Surgeon Generals, if not all. But I would put Dr. Terry as easily the most influential. That warning alone which is probably the most famous warning in all of public health, led to the better health of Americans. And don't forget, 500,000 Americans still die every year because of complications from cigarette smoking. That's 1 out of 5 deaths. So we still have a ways to go.
64 years ago this day, the release of the famed Surgeon General's report on the deadly dangers of cigarette smoking. Dr. Howard Markel, as always, thanks for this moment in medical history.
Thank you so much.
And another little anniversary for us to note. This is the 213th anniversary of the day that likely kept us from saying we live in Indiana. It was on this day, January 11th, 1805, that the territory of Michigan was established by an act of Congress. The territory was carved out of the Indiana Territory. The new Michigan Territory became effective the following June with its first governor of William Hull. And in 1837, Michigan stepped it up and was admitted to the Union as the 26th state. So, happy Not Being Hoosiers Day to all of us. President Trump and his supporters say they want to make America great again. But just what that means and what part of America's past they refer to as great is unclear. And given our nation's turbulent history when it comes to the treatment of people of color and women, there are some who feel that slogan is not meant to include them. A new documentary film strives to address the prejudice and the hatred that we've seen displayed in our nation. The Charlottesville alt-right march is a nationally prominent example, or hateful things scrawled in public places, which has happened in Michigan. This film is Me, the Other. It focuses on a diverse group of students who live in Washtenaw County. Director and co-producer Shadan Majidi is with us now. Welcome to Stateside. So good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thank you so much.
What inspired you to make this film?
I was seeing incidents of hate towards people who are perceived as others in society. And it was really a big shock to me, especially here in New York. We pride ourselves with our diversity. We feel like we're actually quite united within our sort of diverse groups. But to suddenly see people acting not quite humanly towards one another was a huge alarm. So when my friend, who's now the co-producer of this film, called me to celebrate the bicentennial celebrations there in Ann Arbor locally for the University of Michigan, I felt compelled to really want to do something that would be hopefully inspirational as far as like introducing these people who we're suddenly so scared of and we have this fear of. And the idea of this documentary came to me.
Give us a sense of who's in this cast.
We ended up casting 12 people. They come from very diverse backgrounds, each and every single one of them. We have a student from Mexico who is on the DACA program. He is living with his family in fear of deportation. His brother was diagnosed with cancer a few years ago. He's now, I believe, 16 years old. And he, Juan, who was diagnosed with cancer, was born in Ann Arbor. So he's an American citizen. But they live in fear that the rest of the family might be deported, leaving Juan behind. And, of course, he depends solely on the medical care that is being provided to him in this country.
I believe we've actually talked to them here on Stateside, to those brothers. Yes.
I'm sure you have.
We do know them, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we have him. Give us some other stories that we have.
Absolutely. And then we have Christina, who just turned 66 years of age. She had come out as transgender and lost her job. She used to work as a construction worker, lost her family. And years down the line, she basically became drug and alcoholic dependent. And one day woke up and was feeling very suicidal, but she had this miraculous inspiration of, I need to do something with my life. And instead of choosing suicide, she enrolled in Washtenaw Community College and decided to study social work. And the mission was, I need to help people like myself. So she completely turned her life around, and she's now 66 and just transferred to EMU, Eastern Michigan University, to pursue her studies in social work.
And when you say the other with the quotation marks, what does other with the quotation marks mean to you?
The word itself, I think I first came to hear the word more often used in British media and also in Australian media. Otherness is something that's very commonly used. This is an international disease right now. Otherness is referred to people who, I think it was initially referred to towards immigrants, especially Middle Eastern immigrants in European countries. And then otherness became more widely used towards people who are just different to what is seemingly normal. And that's, you know, unfortunately perceived as white, successful, male, mostly, middle class, mostly. So if you don't fit what is considered quote-unquote normal, you are labeled as the other and treated as such. And that's becoming normal and acceptable. And that's creating a lot of bullying in schools. It's creating a lot of division. And most importantly, it's creating so much pain. And I personally couldn't just sit around and allow people to feel pain and hurt. And this idea came to me, and we jumped on it in 6 months. We now have a finished film.
And that film is going to be given a premiere at the Michigan Theater on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which makes me kind of wonder, where do you see us as a nation, as a state, as we talk about people living in Michigan, in achieving that sense of being unified? I mean, did we ever have a time in our nation's history when that unity actually existed, or has it always been a dream or a goal out there?
I feel, and in my gut, I know there will be change, and there is so much hope. I feel that all of these obstacles are tests and challenges that ultimately allow us to get closer to one another and to get to know each other better. And I think what's happening, and one of the reasons I did this film, was I wanted people to listen to each other's stories. I think that's where it really begins. We are so far removed from one another, and I know that the advent of the internet hasn't really helped in many ways.
I think it's made it worse, many say.
Yeah, it's ironic, because really it has brought the world closer to one another, but in a sense, I think the spiritual distance has become greater, so that one-on-one quality time is disappearing. When it starts disappearing from the family life, then God bless us all. But I really do believe that the secret to unity is really, really simple. It's just learning about one another and telling stories and realizing how similar we are. So I have great faith. I have great hope in the future. And I think any small step towards an individual feeling responsible, feeling empowered, that they themselves, every single one of us, is a factor of change. This is why we were created. This is why we were placed on this planet, to see this world as one country, and then to act as a world citizen, so that your scope of care and interest isn't just inwards, it's outwards. So I believe if we created a paradigm shift and looked at the world as one country and felt a sense of patriotism for the world, I think everything is going to shift. But that takes a lot of work, but it really has to begin with us individuals. It sounds utopian, but what choices do we have?
You're right. One might argue it does sound utopian. And there is this sense of some backlash against identity politics. And so, Shadan, what do you say to people who say they're tired of this focus on the other, who say it separates us more than it brings us together?
I think it's just an excuse. People don't want to take the time. People, when they have this fear of the unknown, it's easier to just pretend that it's not there. But what that does is it creates a larger separation, a divide between people. We should think about how can we, as individuals, start bridging those gaps. So instead of dividing, how can we create bridges? It really is about looking inwards and seeing the world and saying, what is the world that I want to live in? If I feel that it's okay to create a community that is about casting aside people who are others, who are different, and then allowing this society that is now accepting bullying at every level to be the new normal, then something is really wrong, and we really need to reprioritize. And that really is the focus, you know, of me as a filmmaker and everybody who's worked on this film. And there's an army of people. I mean, this film was made up of primarily volunteers, people who just believed that this is the message and this is what we need to work towards. So they've given of themselves just to help change the world, one heart at a time. I mean, it really isn't that difficult.
You can find more information about this new documentary, Me, the Other, including the January 15th premiere at the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor, by going to the website, metheotherfilm.com. Co-producer, director Shidan Majidi, thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up next, teaching kids to be entrepreneurs with a chance to turn their business idea into a real startup.
What are things that youth really need today to get them to that next level so that they can solve the world's problems?
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Entrepreneurship.
Part of the community. The next idea.
We are the key to our own recovery.
It is never too early to plant the seeds of entrepreneurship. Today's curious kid could be tomorrow's entrepreneurial star. And that's the idea behind a brand new program called Running Start. It's for middle and high school students. And its founder is here with us now. Deborah Power is president of Running Start and the president of Power Marketing Research in Ann Arbor. Welcome to The Next Idea.
Thanks so much, Cindy, for having me.
So what is Running Start? It's brand new, getting off the ground?
Yeah, well, Running Start is a series of mentor-led workshops for youth to get the skills they need to become entrepreneurs and hopefully eventually start their own businesses.
What kind of skills?
Well, you know, I spoke to Ann Arbor Spark and Michigan Works and others and said, what are the important skills that employers are looking for? They told me that problem solving and creative thinking were really critical issues. So we're going to emphasize those throughout the program.
But as you say, using people who are doing it. So
exactly.
The mentorship thing is very important.
Exactly. So when students are in the workshops, they'll actually be working through their business idea in a variety of ways. They'll have mentors who will lead them through a workbook that has a series of activities. So if you can envision a group of youth sitting together talking about, well, what kind of company could I create? What problem can I solve in the world? So they'll work on these business ideas with the mentors to guide them through the process.
Where'd you get this idea?
Well, I've had the idea for about a year or so now. It just kind of bubbled up in my mind. I said, you know, what are some of the things that are missing? What are things that youth really need today to get them to that next level so that they can solve the world's problems? And this program just sort of coalesced.
It is not instead of skills and things they'd be learning in class, but complementing it.
Exactly. Students today are very savvy about entrepreneurship and business ownership. I started.
Really?
Yeah, they are. It's amazing. I started teaching some Girl Scouts a badge workshop. So if you can remember, if you were a Girl Scout.
I was, yes.
Yeah. You get these badges to
badges.
Wear. So there's a badge now for business ownership. And in a two-hour workshop, we walk through the process of being a business owner. And this was with third graders who came up with viable company ideas. I mean, products that could could be out in the marketplace today.
They could go on Shark Tank and pitch their product to the sharks.
Yes. And I was sort of bowled over. I thought, wow, if these kids are coming up with these ideas now, what could I do with middle and high school students? What would they come up with?
I bet that is the right time, because we've seen this where kids are full of energy and idea and fearless, and then something can happen. Just air quotes around something in middle school and high school where maybe some of that fire goes out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're right. I think at that age, you're fearless about a lot of things. And you're very creative. I mean, there's so much happening to you at that time. It's very powerful. And it's a time when you can become an entrepreneur by thinking about a new, exciting idea.
So you've got a pretty impressive list of mentors. And how did you convince busy, busy people to take time and come on board with this?
Well, this was one of the other astounding things about coming up with the idea of Running Start, is that I put together just a really brief presentation, a series of slides about the program, and took it out on the road and talked to probably 30 or 40 people. And by the time I got to slide number two, they said, "What can I do for you?" So I had people volunteering to sponsor the program and become mentors just immediately. So, a venture capitalist, he says, "What can I do to help you, Deborah?" So people were just enthusiastic. They felt like it was the right time for something like this.
And we often hear that narrative that young people are graduating from school without skills that employers want.
Exactly. How can we ensure that people are creative thinkers and problem solvers in a way that's part of your nature, part of just what you do every day? Even today, when people maybe want to be a data analyst, let's say for Facebook or something like that, it's not just being able to understand what data is, it's being able to do something with that, draw conclusions. And you need those skills at a very early age.
Now, I know you're just getting ready to launch the first cohort of kids through these seminars, and again, middle school and high school track. What happens if somebody comes up with a really viable product and you think, you know what? We could get this going. What might happen?
Right. Well, that's the great thing about Running Start being a startup itself, is that I can do whatever I'd like with it. And I do have that in mind. If the group comes up with an idea or series of ideas that are viable, we would have sort of a phase two where we would involve parents so that the youth can start earning money, signing contracts by their parents, things like that. So sort of a second iteration, maybe more honed in on the skills that they need and bringing in mentors that match up whatever that product or service might be.
So we'll have to check in and see what kinds of ideas.
Yes.
I remember spending a little bit of time in junior achievement when I was in high school, and it's been around since 1919. Do you see Running Start as maybe kind of a JA for the 21st century?
Oh, that's a great way to put it. Well, junior achievement's still around, and they have a great program. I think what we layer on is the mentor piece, is having people like Shelly Sahi, who started a cosmetics company and just recently pitched to a venture capitalist and won $100,000. So it's a little bit more of that real-world experience, bringing people to the workshops that are relatable, that have exciting business ideas. So I think that's a different component that I'm bringing.
Yeah,
to it.
It's another layer. You're in Washtenaw County, but you're open to anyone. How many kids can you take?
Yeah, so we can have 25 middle school and 25 high school students.
And what do they pay for the seminars?
Well, the exciting thing is, because of all of the sponsors I've been able to get, I've got a blend of some paid participants as well as some scholarships. It's $199 for the workshop program, four workshops on four Saturdays, but I have 10 scholarships available for each set of students, so 10 middle and 10 high school students. And we're working with a program through Eastern Michigan University called Bright Futures to administer those scholarships.
Do you have hopes of spreading this through Michigan?
Yes, that would be the next step. The Washtenaw region is a great proving ground for startups and for small businesses and for initiatives like this. So that's why I'm doing it here first. Let's see what happens. What ideas will the youth come up with? How can I make this program better, improve the workbook, better mentors, and then take it on the road? And you're right, I'm thinking Detroit, Grand Rapids, and maybe Flint.
You can get information about the Running Start workshops by going to the website, which is running-start.biz. That's running-start.biz. runningstart.biz. And we've been talking to the founder and president of Running Start, Deborah Power. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us on The Next Idea.
Thanks so much.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
The recent publication of Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury has focused our attention on President Trump's fitness to hold office. Wolff claims White House aides harbor deep concerns about the president's mental health, although the same aides publicly deny that. But the question about Trump's mental fitness predate the Wolff book. Late last year, a group of psychiatrists and mental health experts spelled out their concerns in a book titled The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. Their position is Trump's mental state is a danger to the nation, and they felt it's their duty to warn Americans. Dr. Arash Javanbacht disagrees. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry at Wayne State University. In an editorial published in today's Washington Post, he argues psychiatrists should not be involved in presidential politics. Dr. Javanbacht, welcome. And why do you disagree with your professional colleagues who believe it's their duty to question the president's mental state?
So if you allow me to talk a little bit about the background of this argument. So there are two sides to the argument traditionally. One side is basically rooted in what happened in the 1964 election when Fact magazine sent a poll to some psychiatrists asking about the mental health of Barry Goldwater. And that led to a lawsuit against the Fact magazine, and then the American Psychiatric Association, or APA, released a statement mentioning as an ethical rule that a psychiatrist cannot make a public comment about a person they have not examined and they don't have consent from the person or legal authorities.
So that's called the Goldwater rule.
Exactly, Goldwater rule.
Yes.
But on the other side of the aisle, the group of psychiatrists that have come out over the past 1 year and have raised concerns about the mental health of the president rely on what is called, quote unquote, duty to warn. And duty to warn basically is a rule that if I am seeing a patient and I'm in a doctor-patient relationship with that person, and that person has a chance of or endorses to me that they are going to go harm someone, I have the obligation to inform the potential victim and the legal authorities. And the APA's stance is that, well, here there's no doctor-patient relationship. And that person has not been examined by the psychiatrist. Because this conversation has been going on for the past 1 year.
Very vigorously.
Yes. My approach is from a cost-benefit approach. Regardless of the ethical aspects and regardless of whether the president does or does not have a diagnosis, my approach is, what good does this do and what bad does this do? And I have a lot of concerns about the potential harm it can do to us.
All right, talk about the potential harm.
So the potential harm, at one level, one of the biggest issues with mental health and psychiatry has been the stigma over centuries. Patients have been demonized, have been categorized into the bad people, have been marginalized, they have been embarrassed to talk about their diagnosis, to see a psychiatrist, to seek treatment. Gradually, after a lot of advocacy work and development of our science, learning about the brain, knowing the brain is another part of the body which has its own illness like any other areas in the body, we now have been able to remove the stigma much more, and people feel more comfortable about their diagnosis. Now, in such a highly emotional political atmosphere, it has been very emotional, right?
Certainly.
And there are two sides. Both sides are very emotional. Mm-hmm. When we bring up these issues, we end up with re-stigmatization. Basically, people are, especially when they are highly emotional, prone to stereotype. Then it is us versus them. Whether it is mental health, whether it is politics, whether it is race, whether it is ethnicity, whether it is different countries, whether it is refugees, it's us
them
versus
them. Them and us. Them and us.
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, us, we are good, them are not good. So we are basically using psychiatric diagnosis, telling those who don't like the president that this is because of a psychiatric illness. And then how does that affect the perception of people on both sides of the aisle about mental health, mental illness, and those who do have mental illness? Let's look at that one-third of the country who are supporters of the president.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we are open to a stereotype when emotions are high. Mm-hmm. How would they lump psychiatrists and psychiatry together, and how would they see us? In the context of a lot of the stigma which also surrounds us as psychiatrists, would they, like, let's say, a conservative in a rural area who has been talking to their kids' teachers, and they've been trying to convince them that this kid for ADHD needs psychiatric care. Them seeing us as a bunch of liberals who are trying to push their political agenda. Not that I'm saying this is what is happening, but the way people would
might perceive this.
Exactly. Effort. How's it going to change the chance of them seeking help for their kid? How is it going to change the chance of them seeking treatment for themselves, following up in their treatments? How would they perceive their psychiatrist?
So you're worried it'll shut people down from seeking treatment.
Yeah, and changing the approach. And besides that, so one of the following up on removing the stigma, another factor that we have been successful over the course of several decades achieving has been to bringing empathy, right? When we bring a diagnosis, I use the example of ADHD. We say, hey, this is not a bad kid who doesn't listen in the class and always moving around. This is the disease. This is the ADHD. Basically, we are saying it's not you and it's the illness. So now I don't even know what will this motion achieve by exonerating the person and saying, hey, this is a mental illness.
Okay.
And not the person.
Two of the psychiatrists who are part of that group book have just posted a piece in Politico. They're defending speaking out. Dr. Bandy Lee, who met with members of Congress last week at their request to discuss the president's mental health and behavior, and also Dr. Leonard Glass. They say they are not violating the Goldwater Rule because they say they are not diagnosing Mr. Trump in any specific way. And here's their quote. It is not only acceptable but vitally necessary to have a public conversation about the mental state of our nation's leader. And they're saying their business is whether the president and the commander-in-chief has the capacity to serve in office. So how would you have us address concerns about traits? That's what they say they're talking about, the verbal aggressiveness, the boasting about sexual assaults, impulsiveness, rage reactions, taunting of a hostile nation with nuclear weapons, this, you know, on and on. How would you have us address those concerns?
So a few issues. Number one, in terms of if you do or do not make a diagnosis versus a professional comment, both fit in the Goldwater Rule. But I don't want to get into technicalities. I'm not an ethics specialist, okay? But when it comes to making a diagnosis, you just mentioned several traits, negative traits, which have been discussed on the media and by political pundits since the time of the election and afterwards. If I came out and called this Trumpitis or flying spaghetti monster syndrome, what would that change? So my question is, like, I don't even know how much good these motions will do, because these behaviors have been available to the public. All these behaviors that you mentioned have been seen, and we all know that we don't like these behaviors. And we all know you don't need a psychiatric degree to know that past behavior predicts future behavior. So now me coming and telling you, hey, I want to put this label on these things that you already know, I don't know what is going to change. I am very curious to see how many Republican congressmen and women how many went to that meeting,
mm-hmm.
and how many changed their mind.
Right.
So the idea, what happens, I believe, as a result of these motions, like a lot of other things in politics, those on your side will cheer for you, and the other side will put you in the box of the bad, which may hurt our field. And that's where I am concerned. So I see a lot of patients. I see like 30, 40 patients a week, and my patients would come in during the campaign time. This 80-some-year-old lady would come in and excited, saying that, hey, now that my depression is gone, I have the energy. I'm campaigning for Trump. She was very excited. In the afternoon, this other patient comes in and says how disgusted they are by the behavior of this candidate and how much they hate him. None of these people ask me, what's your political stance? As a person, as a private citizen, I feel very comfortable announcing how I feel about the politics to my friends and family and other people. But as a psychiatrist or as a physician, I'm in a sacred position of neutrality, that the patient coming to me does not even think beforehand, hey, which side is this guy on? Yeah. So they just come in and very comfortably share their ideas. Yeah. And that was very impressive to me, that they see me as a non-political entity, as a neutral person who's there to help them.
And that's an important part of therapy.
Exactly.
Dr. Arash Javanbacht is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Wayne State University, and we've put a link to his Washington Post editorial on the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
It was a pleasure, Cindy. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.